Welcome to the Product Podcast, brought to you by Product School, the podcast where you get fresh insight from leaders at top tech companies and startups. Remember, you can learn product management in person at our 15 campuses worldwide or study with us online. Visit productschool.com to learn more about our courses. You can also hang out with the leaders from these podcasts at our hundreds of annual events and catch us at ProductCon, the world's largest PM conference that takes place every year across the United States and in London.
Chapter 3, Creating an Opportunity Hypothesis. A key part of your role as a product manager is understanding your customers and their problems and needs, and making sure what you're building next is right for them, be it a feature or a new product. At the end of the day, very few companies fail because their technology doesn't work. Companies fail for lack of customers. Here's a dirty secret. Everyone thinks they know what their customers need. But like we mentioned in Chapter 1, most people, even your boss's boss, really have no idea what customers need until they've done some work. Every company has a different approach to figuring out what customers want, and there are tweets, blog posts, books, and epic operas about how to do so. Well, maybe not operas. Yet. We're going to take an approach modeled on the scientific method. Come up with a hypothesis about your customers' needs and how you can address them, then validate or invalidate it. This chapter will cover different ways to generate a hypothesis. Chapter 4 will discuss how to validate it, and Chapter 5 will help you transition from ideation to execution. Keep in mind, what we're teaching you is just one way to approach figuring out what to do next, albeit it is a good one. A lot of the content in this chapter is a bit chicken and egg. Some of the material we taught in Chapter 2 comes into play here, as does future material from the customer development section of Chapter 4. Customer development can influence your personas, use cases can inform opportunities, and so on. Rather than debate ad nauseum where to start, we've chosen an approach. We encourage you to keep a similar mental model, based on the scientific method, no matter where you start, so that you're always making informed decisions about what to do next. You have opinions, not facts. There's some bad news you should know up front. Generally, less than 50% of ideas you'll execute, even awesome ideas, improve the metrics they're supposed to improve. Amazon tests all its new ideas and has data to back up this 50% figure. Yammer follows a similar practice and has seen similar numbers. As a product manager, you want to find ways to spend your time on features that matter. This starts with accepting that your ideas start off as opinions and not facts. It's sometimes very hard for product managers to grasp that their opinions are not necessarily truth. We like being right, and we're taught in school that it's bad to be wrong. The real world, and building products, isn't like that. It's okay to be wrong, but we want to figure out if we're wrong as soon as possible, and course correct before we put lots of resources into our incorrect opinions. If you're wrong, but insist you're right, the product will fail. But if you're wrong, realize it quickly and adjust accordingly, you're much more likely to succeed. How often has someone said to you, "I have a $1 million idea for a product that does X," and the voice inside your head answers, "I wouldn't buy it." Lots of people have opinions about what product or feature to build. Everyone assumes they're average and that if they want something, lots of other people do too. Because of this, many people go immediately from an idea right to building it, never once seeing if others would actually buy the product. Early-stage startups frequently have this problem. These are also often the startups that eschew product management. Unfortunately, these companies end up in trouble because after spending lots of money to build a product, they find out no one wants it. As a result, bad things happen, ranging from their abandoning the product without recouping their investment to going out of business. Wouldn't it be great if you could limit these disaster scenarios in a cost-effective way? The approach we're going to teach you, focused on creating and validating an idea, will let you quickly and cheaply filter out ideas that won't help you. Note, we're not talking about bad ideas. An idea could be good, but just not help you or your customers. Steve Blank, a tech entrepreneur, worked with a number of startups and noticed a trend in the ones that failed. Specifically, these startups would focus on their business plans and go right to product development, skipping any validation of their fundamental idea. Sound familiar? By the time a startup would get feedback from customers, it would be so far down a path that it'd be tough to make changes. Blank noticed that startups failed mainly due to lack of customers and a profitable business model, and the ones he worked with and their investors didn't see value in taking time to figure out if people really wanted what they were building. Ironically, this disconnect was especially an issue for the startup's founders, who created the initial hypothesis the company was founded on. They quickly became isolated from direct customer feedback as they hired people such as marketers to interact with customers for them. Blank's work led him to conclude that in a startup, no facts exist inside the building, only opinions. He then created the idea of customer development, which essentially says that whatever you come up with at first is an opinion. You might be wrong, and you need to interact with real potential customers to learn the truth ASAP. This chapter is about forming a good opinion. Chapter 4 is about how to find out the truth about your opinion. Customer development became a core part of Lean methodology, which we briefly mentioned in Chapter 1. Lean Startup is a business that applies a product developmental methodology adapted by Steve Blank and Eric Ries from Toyota's revolutionary manufacturing pipeline to product or software development. Lean Startup is focused on helping companies be successful by quickly and iteratively determining what customers want, building something that fills only that need, validating the solution, and repeating. Customer development is a key part of Lean Startup because it's a way to quickly increase your learning so as to avoid wasting time. We believe this approach is useful both in startups trying to develop their initial product and in established companies improving existing products. After all, a great PM needs to help the customer be awesome, and you want to focus your time on building things they need. With this in mind, how do you create the best possible hypothesis about what your customers want? What's your goal, and how do you want to achieve it? The very first thing to establish is your goal for this product development lifecycle iteration. Is your company focused on acquiring new users? Does it want to improve revenue? There's no silver bullet to pick the right goal to focus on. If you've achieved a core set of engaged customers who continuously use your product, perhaps your next goal will be revenue followed by growth. Your main priority is to pick a specific goal. What you pick to work on next will be in service of this goal, and this is the core of how PMs strategically choose what to work on next. Next, you need to think about how to achieve that high-level goal with an actual product. How do you want to achieve that goal at a high level? Do you want to iterate on an existing product, finding ways to improve it? Do you want to build something completely new, a blue sky opportunity, also sometimes called blue water or ocean? In making this decision, you can focus your thinking so that you can determine the details about what to build to achieve your goal. Let's look at iteration first. Start by translating your higher-level business goal into a product goal, then focus on what changes we can make to a product to help meet that goal. For example, the company might want improved customer satisfaction, which could translate into getting customers to read more articles, because that's a sign customers like the content. Another example of using iteration to achieve a goal is when Facebook changed the like button to have different types of reactions, such as love, sadness, and anger. Facebook's goal might have been to get more engagement, and the Facebook PMs implicitly knew they wanted to improve the core product rather than build something new. They decided to provide users with more post-feedback reactions. Liking a post about someone's dog dying never seemed like the right reaction, and some users probably chose to post nothing rather than like the post. The sad reaction now provides an easy way to give the poster feedback, leading to more engagement on posts. Iterations aren't just small changes, though. An iteration might be a complete overhaul or rewrite of the app or a feature, like when Gmail redid its Compose interface, or when Apple switched from skeuomorphism to flat design in iOS 7. The key definition of an iterative change is that you're taking an existing product and making it better. Iteration is incredibly important, as the first version of a product is never perfect for all customers, and it's through iteration that a product evolves to become something customers love. If you don't have product or market fit yet, we'd recommend focusing on achieving it before trying to focus on revenue or growth goals. What is also nice about iteration is that you already have information about how the customers are using the product, and your hypothesis about what to do next might come from quantitative sources, like how many users complain about a bug, or qualitative sources, like ideas the support team has. The downside to iteration is that you can get stuck finding the local maxima. This means that you've optimized something really well, but you focused so much on optimization that you missed a bigger shift that happened. Think about Blockbuster Video. Blockbuster could have spent lots of time iterating and come up with the ideal balance of price and rental days versus late fees. It might have also iterated on the overall store experience, aiming to optimize number of rentals per customer, and come up with an in-store recommendation tool to optimize customer satisfaction, ensuring that every customer walked out with a movie. However, it still would have gone out of business because it missed the global change where customers switched to streaming video. This is where blue sky thinking comes into play. A blue sky opportunity is something totally new. The biggest blue sky examples occur when you believe the market or world is changing in a certain way, and you need to make a big transformation to address a need that might not exist yet, but you believe will exist in the future. While maybe you could make changes to your existing product to address this opportunity, this new opportunity is different enough that it's best addressed by building something new, designing from the ground up to take advantage of that opportunity. Blue sky opportunities also arise when you see a new opportunity to expand your business into areas it doesn't serve right now because you believe those areas will have future value. To put it simply, blue sky opportunities are about skating to where the puck will be, not where it is now. Sometimes blue sky opportunities arise by thinking more broadly or reframing how you're approaching a problem. Blockbuster saw its business as video stores and was locked into handing customers tapes and DVDs. Netflix focused on content delivery, and it didn't matter if that content came from the mail or streaming video. By thinking about how to let customers watch movies and TV shows in a different way, Netflix saw a means to exceed Blockbuster's local maxima and find a new global maxima. Another example of reframing to find a blue sky opportunity is the life insurance company MetLife. The company made an app, Infinity, to create your digital legacy by curating your memories. Digital legacies are becoming far more of an issue than they were even 10 years ago. Your life insurance company is the one business that knows for sure if you're alive. So who better to trust with the key to passing on your photos, documents, and more when you die? Sometimes, new technology and trends, like cloud computing, change how we solve problems, creating new opportunities. Looking at photo management, we've moved from physical albums to digital tools, such as iPhoto. But even after iPhoto had been out for about 15 years, an eternity for technology, Apple decided the future of photo management was in the cloud. Rather than try to make iPhoto capable of managing a cloud-based photo library, Apple deprecated iPhoto in favor of an entirely new product, Photos. Unlike iPhoto, Photos was built from the ground up for iOS, since most people take their photos with a smartphone rather than a digital camera. Another example of new technology creating blue sky opportunities is when Facebook, recognizing the potential of virtual reality, VR, spent $2 billion to purchase Oculus, believing that the future value of Oculus VR in its metaverse to connect everyone together would be huge and more than justify that price. The downside to blue sky thinking is the potential risk. Blue sky thinking always requires a guess, even if it's a well-educated one, about what is going to happen, and developing blue sky products takes resources away from iterating on existing products with real customers. New products almost always lose money at first, because in addition to taking resources to develop, you must convince customers to use this new tool, causing key metrics will be lower at first. This risk factor is where the innovator's dilemma comes from. It's hard for incumbent companies to justify trying to build the next big thing when they could be spending their money growing their current product, finding the local maxima. This leads companies to focus too much on their short-term goals, missing larger opportunities because of the short-term drop in profits that would result. After all, their current business is doing well. Why change? For this reason, private startups that can find new opportunities stand a chance of disrupting an incumbent. Did anyone expect taxis to be as disrupted as they have been by the smartphone app-based business model and the sharing economy? Of course, big companies don't want to be disrupted, so they're also often trying to find blue sky opportunities. Alphabet is a great example of how a big company can address the innovator's dilemma. Most of Alphabet's revenue comes from Google search ads. If the company just sat around optimizing that revenue, it'd have a few really great years. But Alphabet knows that business model won't last forever, and it would rather find the next big thing before someone else does. Alphabet is constantly trying to come up with the next big thing, and some of its work, such as self-driving cars, looks promising but hasn't paid off yet, whereas other investments didn't work out as well as Alphabet hoped, like buying Boston Dynamics. Unfortunately, if you follow Alphabet stock, you'll see that investors don't like all these experimental bets. They want to see choices that give immediate returns. If you have an existing product, it's totally reasonable if your first opportunity hypothesis focuses on iteration rather than blue sky improvements. But as you work to validate your hypothesis, you might realize the best way to achieve your goals and address your customer's need is by building something new. Thus far, you should have established a high-level company goal, translated that goal to a product goal with key success metrics, why you're making this change, and thought about if you want to accomplish your goal by changing your existing product or building something new, how you're going to accomplish this goal. Now, let's look at how we come up with what specifically we can do to accomplish this goal. Quantitatively finding an opportunity hypothesis. There are two major ways to determine what we want to do to achieve our goal: qualitative reasoning and quantitative reasoning. Quantitative reasoning involves looking at data, interpreting it, and using that analysis to determine what to do next. Qualitative reasoning involves more abstract concepts, like looking at your overall product vision or your intuition based on your knowledge of your customers in determining the next step to take. We'll look at quantitative reasoning first because it's the most common way PMs determine what to build next. Quantitative sources are important because they allow us to collect data on how people actually use our product, to use that data to find insights, and then to apply those insights to determine what to do next. For example, perhaps Lyft wants to increase customer retention by getting people to use Lyft instead of Uber. We can turn that into a specific product goal by focusing on how to decrease the number of rides canceled. Fewer cancellations means more passengers served and happier drivers, which means more payment. This will also come by tweaking the current product rather than building something new. When you cancel a ride in Lyft, you need to specify a reason. A PM at Lyft could look at the responses and come up with ideas about how to mitigate those reasons. Maybe he notices that midday, the number of people canceling their rides due to wait times skyrockets compared to the morning or evening. As a result, perhaps he'd find ways to incentivize drivers to be on the road midday, decreasing wait times, decreasing cancellations, and ultimately keeping customers in a Lyft rather than an Uber. Quantitative sources are also nice because after we've come up with and implemented our idea, we can compare the data before and after the change and determine if it was successful. Our Lyft PM would compare the percentage of rides being canceled and the reasons why to see if his change decreased the number of cancellations. It's worth noting that quantitative sources are useful for both iterative and blue sky opportunities, as are qualitative sources. Data on how customers use your current product might yield ways you can iterate the current product, or they could point out a trend that reveals an opportunity for a blue sky project. Metrics and analytics. How do you know what to do if you don't know what your customers are doing? As we've discussed before, metrics are measurements of different tasks users do within your product. Metrics are the most common source of quantitative data about your product and your customers. Metrics take many forms, from how many people do you swipe right or left on per person in this app, to how many people who came to your site via a specific affiliate's link completed a purchase. In chapters 1 and 2, we talked about success metrics, which are the key indicators of if you're achieving your goals and if your customers are winning. When working with metrics, start by asking yourself if you're happy with where your success metric is. Is it at the right level to effectively achieve your product goal? And if not, how can you improve this success metric? Not every metric is a success metric. For example, our key success metric might be how many people complete a purchase, but we'll also measure how many people add items to a cart and how many people tap the checkout button. Put together, these metrics give us a sense of what's going on comprehensively with the product. If lots of people tap the checkout button, but very few actually complete a purchase, then we might have an opportunity to improve the checkout workflow so that more people complete a purchase. Workflows are often called funnels and are great sources of opportunity hypotheses. We'll cover them shortly. We call the process of gathering and analyzing these metrics collectively analytics. Analytics lets you understand the state of your product, giving you a much better idea about what your customers are doing and how your product's working for them. Analytics make metrics useful by giving them context, allowing you to deliver insights about what to do next. Think about metrics as individual data points, such as a car's position, how fast it's traveling, the number of passengers, etc. In addition to seeing a success metric like the user turned the car off after driving for a while, analytics puts those data points together to help you realize the family's taking their weekly drive to grandma's house. Analytics also let you see if the family made it to grandma's or if they ran out of gas. If the family constantly runs out of gas before achieving their goal of getting to grandma's, you, as a PM, will look for ways to help them not run out of gas. Okay, this metaphor's run out of gas. Let's move on. Analytics and metrics are useful for several reasons. The first is that people often aren't aware of exactly what they do, and numerous studies have shown that self-reporting usage is unreliable. Automatically recording their actions lets us see what people are really doing with our product and how they got there. If your product is very large, analytics can reveal a problem on one specific section that you might not find manually. Imagine if you were a PM at Amazon and you wanted to watch how many people bought each product. If people stop buying various products, that's a warning you should look at the product to see what's up. If you asked everyone what they bought, you'd have an impossible task because of the customer volume. If you randomly surveyed people, you'd likely miss many niche products. Automated analytics, however, could easily find a product where the number purchased suddenly dropped from an average of 5 per day to 0. Finally, when you look at analytics over time, you can get a gauge for where you're going. Perhaps your growth rate has leveled off. If you're unhappy with your trajectory, you'll dig into the component metrics to find the problem, and determining a new way to address that problem will form your opportunity hypothesis. Again, after you've implemented the solution, you can reevaluate these metrics to see if your strategy worked. There are many analytics tools, with Google Analytics and Mixpanel being two of the most popular for web and mobile apps. Adding these tools to your product is fairly straightforward and just requires a bit of tracking code and annotations so that you can track specific things, such as how many times a user clicks play on a video. Physical products often require completely different analytics techniques, but as more products become connected, it's possible to collect similar usage data. It's worth noting that analytics data isn't always perfect, and those imperfections can skew your analysis. If your app supports multiple platforms, the event might accidentally be tagged as Event A on Android and Event A on iOS. This means you won't see the total times Event A happens unless you notice the problem and account for it. Other times, there are inherent issues in your analytics tools. Google Analytics only samples a subset of your traffic for its reports, but for high-traffic websites, that sample might not accurately represent your real data. If the data doesn't correctly represent what your customers are doing, you might make the wrong decisions. Let's dig into how to use analytics to look at specific metrics and find opportunities. Breaking down analytics. The first part of analytics is to make sure we're capturing the right metrics. Identify the key success metric supporting your goal and the metrics that support that goal. If your success metric is how engaged your customers are, you should track how often they complete the core success action and the steps that lead to it. If the right metrics aren't there, then your first task for this iteration of the product development lifecycle is to implement analytics for those metrics. One common problem when you inherit an existing project is that a previous, well-meaning PM has been recording every single possible metric. This leads to data overload, and it can be very hard to sort out the useful metrics from the irrelevant ones. If you find yourself in that situation, we recommend doing an analytics audit and reassessing what data points you're recording, removing the irrelevant ones before using the data to make decisions. The next part is how we group metrics together so that we can spot trends and opportunities. There are three key ways: segmentation, cohort analysis, and funnels. Analytics track every customer equally and report the average behavior. For example, a new customer will use an app's first use tutorial. Some might skip it, but a returning customer won't even see the first use tutorial. If you simply looked at how often a customer views the tutorial out of how many times people use the app, it'd look like a very few people use the tutorial overall. It's up to you to segment your data, which means grouping it by common characteristics. Analytic tools often provide multiple ways to segment data. Common choices range from technical grouping, OS, browser, etc., to behavioral, new, returning user, to demographics, country, language are common. After segmenting data, we can look at each metric, focusing on our key success metric and the supporting metrics, and see if it's in line with our baseline expectation. If it's not, we'll flag this as a metric to focus on. You might find something surprising for a metric unrelated to what you're working on right now. Feel free to note it for later, but don't worry about it initially. There are lots of metrics for a product, and PMs can always find surprises. We're focused on a specific success metric and the supporting metrics that lead to that success metric. Another way of grouping data is cohort analysis. This is very similar to segmentation, but it uses a point in time as a key characteristic of the group and is often used to look at behavior over time. For example, imagine your products featured on TV's Shark Tank, Dragon's Den in the UK, where hopeful entrepreneurs pitch their idea to investors. You might want to compare how users who signed up before Shark Tank aired use the product compared to people who sign up later. And you'd also ask how those cohorts' usage compares after 2 months, after 6 months, etc. Or more practically, what's customer engagement like over time with customers from before you created the first use tutorial compared to customers who signed up after you implemented the tutorial? If you see a substantial difference in behavior at a certain point, flag that metric. The last common method of grouping data is a funnel. This is where you measure key steps along a user's journey towards some task and group them together in journey order. Typically, a lot of people complete the first step and far fewer complete the last. E.g., many people might go to an Amazon product page, a smaller number click Add to Cart, and a smaller number still complete the checkout. Leakage is when a customer stops moving forward in the funnel. Nearly any sequential action group of metrics, workflow, can form a funnel, and your goal is always to look at how a user goes from initiating to completing an action. Not every customer enters your product the same way, e.g., tapping an app on the home screen to open it the first time, opening the app for the 10th time with a restored state, tapping a link that opens the app, etc. Your analytics tool likely has a behavior flow report to see how users enter the funnel and where they go. Any place there's a substantial, undesired falloff is a potential opportunity, and you should flag that particular metric. Dave McClure, the well-known venture capitalist who founded 500 startups, put together a talk called Startup Metrics for Pirates, where he came up with a general approach to metrics for an entire product called AARRR Metrics, although he put it together for startups where the success of a company depends on one product, it's useful for any product. The acronym stands for the following: Acquisition, how the user comes to your product. Activation, the user's first visit to your product and her first happy experience. Retention, the user liked your product enough to use it again, and hopefully again and again. Referral, the user likes it enough to tell someone about it. Revenue, the user finds your product valuable enough that she pays for it. McClure suggests breaking down the key behavioral steps for your product into these buckets. Each bucket might have more than one metric within it, and using this funnel to see how users go from discovering your product to being willing to pay. Each large dip is a potential opportunity and a metric to flag, and the ones towards the top of the funnel are the ones to address first. Note that the parts of the funnel you focus on will depend on your company and product goals. If your current goal is growth, you'd focus on the activation step rather than the revenue step. It's also important to note that not every dip in a funnel is bad. For example, the Nigerian spam emails asking you to provide your bank account to a prince or something similar have only a 0.1% click-through rate, meaning only 0.1% of the people who receive it click the send money link. But this turns out to be an excellent filter for gullible customers, as 70% of the people who click the link actually send money. If they optimize the click-through rate and 90% of people click the link, it's more likely that the site would be reported or taken down, and the spammer would make less money overall. Ultimately, no matter how you look at your analytics, your goal is to find a metric you believe is worth improving in order to achieve your product and company goals. Chapter 3 Tip. This tip is from Beatrice de Tangle. Beatrice has worn several hats in the startup world. She's used her analyst experiences to land product management positions where she drives decisions from data and insights. Her focus at Product School is on how to use data and communicate metrics effectively. You can reach out to her via Twitter at BZData. What are the key differences between vanity and success metrics? If you ask what makes a great product manager, many will say it's an understanding of what goes where and how. Not as simple when you're toggling between Excel spreadsheets, SQL queries, and visualized infographics. We live in a time when data lives everywhere. A product manager should know how to extract insight from the right place. Let's look at how to do so using Amazon as an example. Start by understanding the products and the company's overall value proposition. For Amazon, the value proposition to customers is the convenience of buying anything and getting it quickly. As a PM, you will need to think from the customer's perspective. If they choose your product or company out of all the competition for the key value proposition, you will need to know how parts of the product are performing to make sure the value proposition stays intact. What metrics do customers care about that support the value proposition? These include inventory of every item, number of items stocked with inventory compared to top lists or holiday shopping guides, percent of items ordered and arriving within an Amazon Prime shipping window, about 48 hours, average load speed of the website, average wait time between submission of a service ticket and resolution. If a website were slow or deliveries weren't on time, customers wouldn't necessarily think Amazon is convenient. If we fail to deliver on the above metrics, we wouldn't deliver on our value proposition to customers, and they'd shop elsewhere. Conversely, when we deliver on these metrics, customers are happy. This means these are success metrics we should focus on. Well, what are vanity metrics then? Eric Ries first spoke of vanity metrics in 2009, defining them as metrics often spoken of at a top-level view. These are often also referred to in acronyms: page views, number of installs, daily or monthly users, DAU, growth in users, installs, page views. It's great if lots of people look at Amazon each day and go to Amazon first, but if they don't complete their transactions on Amazon, then Amazon isn't winning. In other words, these metrics don't tell us if we're making our customers happy or not. Vanity numbers are great for a quick headline. However, success comes with context. Be sure to look for metrics that matter towards a successful experience for the customer. Turning metrics into opportunities by asking why. The challenge with quantitative sources like metrics is that they'll tell you what is happening, but not why. Once you've identified a metric, or two, that you want to improve, how do you figure out what to do? There are a few ways to figure out what you should do, and one of the easiest is by asking why. Specifically, ask yourself why you think the metric isn't where you want it to be. And if the answer isn't a hypothesis that you can test somehow, continue to ask yourself why until you get to a specific hypothesis. Your goal is to get to the core problem, the root of the deeper issue. You want to solve problems, not address symptoms. Asking why can help you find that core problem, leading you to the potential opportunity to focus on validating. Here are a few ideas to help you. First, many people only focus on the end result of the funnel. They might say, "Not enough customers complete a purchase." If this is the case, ask yourself why. Look back up through the funnel and see where the leakage occurs. Then, ask why it's occurring there. You might need to go to that particular part of the product to see what might be blocking a user. Segmenting your audience and focusing in on how each segment behaves can lead to a better hypothesis. For example, perhaps your site's conversion rate looks low overall, but when you segment it by browser, you see the conversion rate for Safari customers is much higher than for Chrome customers. Given there are more Chrome customers than Safari ones, the overall average conversion rate appears low. As you ask yourself why and try using the site in Chrome yourself, maybe you'll find a bug where a JavaScript error appears when you click checkout in Chrome. Your opportunity hypothesis is that fixing this bug will improve acquisition for the shopping cart page and eventually increase revenue. Here are a few common, interesting opportunities you'll find for mobile and web apps in metrics. A low time on a screen and a high bounce rate, people who leave after viewing this content, on a page that's supposed to be important, likely indicates a mismatch between expectations and reality. The content wasn't what the customer expected, so they left. A long time on a screen and a high bounce rate could be fine if the page is a long article, but if it's a page with very little content but lots of links, it could indicate the screen is unclear. A high number of screen views could indicate that this part of the app is important, therefore, you need to optimize it well. A low number of views could mean this section is hard to find. If your product has only one feature that people use frequently, you're easily replaceable in their workflow. Ideally, you'll have a few key features that people use frequently so that you're not a throwaway product when something better in one area comes along. If there's an important feature you believe is for all customers, but only some customers use, you'll want to improve its adoption. To do so, focus on asking why, just like we discussed before. Note that you want to be very explicit. Don't just say, customers don't see its value. Keep asking why until you get to the root cause. Why don't they see its value? The feature doesn't save them time. Why doesn't it save them time? There are too many steps to use the feature. Why are there too many steps? Eventually, you'll come up with a list of issues preventing customers from adopting the feature. Time saving might only be one of many reasons a customer doesn't see a feature's value. Once you've done this, you can focus on resolving those issues. Not all opportunities will be code changes either. It's possible different marketing or design will help adoption. If there's a feature that many customers use infrequently, but you think would be beneficial if they used it more, it's possible users aren't clear how it works, which you can check via a funnel. You can also check the value with the help of marketing. To motivate users to use it more, you can use the Hook Canvas by Nir Eyal, author of Hooked, to help create habits in your software. The Hook Canvas has four elements. First is the trigger. What happens to get the user to the product? Second, what's the absolute simplest thing you can get a customer to do that will give them the reward? Third, what reward can you provide that's fulfilling and makes the user want more and invest in the product? Last, what tiny bit of action can you get the customer to invest in doing that will lead to more triggers and get them to return? If you've heard of gamification, which involves adding gaming mechanisms to use non-game products, you've seen the Hook Canvas in action. You might get an email from an airline saying you'll get bonus points if you sign up for a credit card. You fill out the simplest form the airline can give you and, assuming you're approved, you get enough points for a free domestic trip. That makes you want to earn more points to get more free trips. Surveys. Another way of gathering data to find opportunities is by sending out surveys, trying to gauge user satisfaction with different parts of your product amongst statistically significant parts of your user base. In Chapter 2, we discuss the most common high-level approach to determining satisfaction, a Net Promoter Score, NPS. Again, it's simply the question, on a scale of 1 to 10, how likely is it that you would recommend brand to a friend or colleague? Higher scores mean customers are happy, and lower scores mean they're likely to be neutral or tell people not to buy your product. It's good to dive in beyond a general NPS and ask how satisfied customers are with specific parts of your product. If they're less than a 10, have an open-ended question for feedback about how the product isn't meeting their needs and expectations. As you make changes to the product, you can resurvey to see how satisfaction changes over time. Some products are now integrating this satisfaction survey into the product. For example, random Twitter customers will see a tweet in their timeline saying they've been selected for a survey, and tools like Intercom, Delighted, and User Voice can be easily integrated and allow customers to provide feedback continuously. Surveys can be used to gather more specific data, and we'll cover crafting good ones in more depth in Chapter 4 when we look at how to use them to validate our hypothesis. Obviously, if a customer isn't satisfied and tells you why, that's a potential source of an opportunity hypothesis. But there are other ways to use survey data to find an opportunity, especially creating an importance versus satisfaction graph. Internally, you should have a sense of how important each feature is to the product. The features that are core to the product and used most often are likely the most important. For each feature, if you create a graph with customer satisfaction on the y-axis, increasing feature importance on the x-axis, and a y equals x line, you'll easily spot opportunities. An important feature that has low satisfaction will appear below the line, and it should be your first priority to improve. Generally, you'll trade off importance versus how unsatisfied customers are, so you might work on something that's fairly important with very low satisfaction, before focusing on a feature that's very important with moderate satisfaction. It's also fine if less important features have lower overall satisfaction. They're not critical to the product. Should those features become more important, then you should focus on improving them so that the user satisfaction stays above the X equals Y line. What about customer interviews? It's possible that while you're talking to customers, for example, while user testing another feature, they might say something that sparks an idea in your mind. However, we believe that customer interviews should not be the source of your first opportunity hypothesis. If you start customer interviews without even a vague sense of what you're looking to learn, the interviews will be unfocused and not useful, and you're unlikely to find a good hypothesis. Instead, we believe you should start with an opportunity hypothesis, even if it's vague, and then do customer interviews to validate it. It's possible that while doing those interviews, you'll come up with a new hypothesis, and that's fine. Qualitatively finding an educated opportunity hypothesis. Not every opportunity arises from something that can be quantified and measured. As Henry Ford supposedly said, "If I had asked people what they wanted, they would have said a faster horse." Someone else once said that data-driven optimization, taken to its extreme, just leads to porn. You can pull from a wide range of qualitative resources to find opportunities. The biggest challenge is that these will take more work to validate than quantitatively found opportunities, as they don't come directly from data. You'll have to find data to support them. Known bugs and sugs. The simplest qualitative iterative opportunity, which is also arguably quantitative, to look for is how a bug might be blocking customers from succeeding. For example, if you're trying to improve revenue and the QA team discovers that when customers in Europe try to pay, your app crashes while handling the US dollar to euro rate conversion, then the next thing you might choose to work on is fixing that crashing bug. The main way you'll validate a bug-related opportunity hypothesis is by looking for data about how big of an issue the bug is, how often does it occur, and what impact does it have on the success metric. Maybe that conversion bug hasn't been reported by any actual users, and it's really something in the QA team's setup causing it. Or, if only a tiny portion of your customers are in Europe, then there are likely other ways to improve revenue you should focus on first. It might seem silly to explicitly list bugs as an opportunity to explore, If you're an engineer, you'd likely prefer to have no bugs. But one of a PM's challenges is to weigh the overall value of fixing a bug against that of not fixing the bug and doing something else instead. Quality is always important, but not every bug is a high enough priority to go fix immediately. Similarly, there might be existing SUGs or feature requests in your backlog, which become the basis for your hypothesis. These might have come from a variety of places, ranging from random ideas people have had to data-driven sources like customer support tickets and insights from usability studies, studies where you test how real customers interact with the existing product or feature and note what they do well and what stumbling blocks they encounter. Related to this is paying off technical debt. Sometimes engineering has to make internal changes that essentially do the dishes in the code. It's important to periodically prioritize this engineering work because if you don't, it will become harder and harder to implement new features down the road. Unfortunately, when you work on these projects, from a customer perspective, nothing changes. To validate this opportunity, you'll want to make sure that this is a good time to work on an internal cleanup rather than to deliver something new to customers, and that this internal cleanup will provide value to your team down the road, such as making it easier to implement another opportunity on the roadmap. Intuition. How many times have you heard someone say, "I've got an idea for an app. Do you know anyone who can build it for me?" Sometimes there are good ideas, like being able to use an app to easily hail a car at an attractive price. Other times, someone wants to build an app to help match their socks to their trousers. Clearly, no one has good ideas all the time, not even Steve Jobs. Remember the iPod sock? A common source of opportunity hypotheses is existing hypotheses you or your company might already have based on your experience or prior knowledge. This is a great place to start because you likely do have a strong idea of what to build for your customers from your experience, but it's also potentially dangerous because this type of hypothesis often doesn't get validated properly. Many times, people are afraid of someone stealing their idea, which rarely actually happens, or they just don't want to find out that no one actually wants their idea. Unfortunately, the second step for many first-time product builders isn't to validate their idea, but rather to jump immediately into building it. People like to assume that if they have a problem, many other people do too, and these people will want their solution. This is risky because it might be very costly to build a product, and no one knows for sure if anyone else experiences this same problem or is interested in the same solution as they are. The best way to come up with an idea on your own is not to think about what you, the individual, want, but to really empathize with your target personas, combining your knowledge of your customers' pain points with your knowledge of what you could build and the overall goals and success metrics that matter to the product and the company. As a PM, you're in a unique position to know what the major pain points for customers are, how they're reacting to your product, what the technical issues are with your product, and what technical innovations have occurred within your engineering team. We'll show you a tool shortly called the Business Model Canvas to make the synthesis of this idea more concrete. A great PM will also be paying attention to the broader tech world, thinking about how innovations elsewhere might apply to his product and customers. Here's a simple example of an intuition-derived hypothesis for Mover. They want to make booking a move as easy as calling an Uber, so that means making it simple for moving companies to provide accurate estimates. Photos could help moving companies make accurate estimates, but people likely don't know how to take useful photos to show a space for moving companies. What if they added a feature where we had the customer stand in the middle of each room, slowly moving their camera up and down as the customer spun around, generating a 360-degree photo on screen? That way, every customer takes a good photo of the space in question. We can hypothesize that the result will make it easier for moving companies to give an accurate estimate. The next step would be to validate that photos, especially 360-degree ones, make it substantially easier for moving companies to make accurate estimates. This could be done by using an existing 360-degree app to take photos of a space and send both them and regular photos of a space to various moving companies asking for their feedback. Vision. You, your boss, your company, etc., likely have an overall vision for your products and the company that you want to achieve on a longer time horizon. Specifically, it's an image of the future version of the company you're trying to create. For Walt Disney, this meant looking at some land in Florida and having a vision of Disney World, knowing that everything he wanted to do next would be about building Cinderella's castle. For you, maybe you want to migrate from a locally deployed at client's solution to a cloud-based one. You'll need to take steps along the way to achieve this long-term vision, and you might choose to make one of these steps your next opportunity. As an aside, hopefully someone has done some validation on the overall vision. The challenge with these opportunities is assessing whether you can provide an immediate value to customers or if it's delayed gratification. If you believe this opportunity will have an immediate benefit, validate it like any other opportunity. But if it's something that will take longer for customers to benefit from, you might only do some internal validation to ensure it makes sense to work on this project right now, since it takes resources away from other projects. Team ideas. One of a PM's biggest challenges is a soft skill, soft power. No one reports to a PM. You can't tell people what to do. Instead, you need to earn people's trust. And a great way to do that is to look at building a product as a team sport and not departments working in silos. No, it's not a democracy, and at the end of the day, you'll often be the one making calls about a product. But if other people know you listened to and acted upon their input, they'll feel included in the decision-making process and happier with your decisions. A great place to include other teams is in this ideation step. There are likely other teams that work closely with the customers, such as design, customer support, business development, and sales. Reach out to people on those teams and see what thoughts they've had based on their experience with customers and the product. Support teams especially appreciate this, as they spend all day working with actual customers, and they have great visibility into what the customers are doing with the product and saying about it. They often can provide data like support tickets to back up their ideas. Beyond talking directly with other teams, you can organize a group brainstorming session. There are pros and cons to these sessions. A big pro is that many people feel included, and one idea might inspire someone else to build upon it with a different idea. For example, the sales team might make one feature request that they think would help the product sell better. And the support team might mention there are a lot of tickets around that entire feature set, so perhaps it should be completely redone. A big downside to group brainstorming is that people often fixate on a few ideas or ways of thinking, missing other opportunities. As the group facilitator, you need to help get the creative juices flowing. One way to do that is to have everyone share the worst ideas they can think of, then figure out ways to make those ideas even worse. After you've done that, flip over and focus on how to make the product better. Make sure to keep these sessions at least a little focused by listing your current product goals and success metrics. If you want to brainstorm ideas to increase engagement, for example, you're not going to want to talk about putting more ads in the product. R&D. Related to teamwork, sometimes there are new inventions that a brilliant engineer or team of engineers creates. What's nice about these inventions is that there's usually a prototype of some form so that you can see it in action. Adding these inventions to the product, called productizing, is often how products are pushed into the next generation, and they can be a major source of customer delight because the customer didn't expect or ask for them. However, it can often be a rocky road from prototype to product, and the initial product might have significant trade-offs or limitations. If you choose to pursue an opportunity like this, make sure to work closely with engineering to understand all the challenges you'll need to solve to make this prototype useful to customers in their daily lives. The competition. Stravinsky, Faulkner, Picasso, regardless of who said it, you might have heard the quote, "Good artists copy, great artists steal." Sometimes your competition has a great idea, and stealing it and making it better is your opportunity. Be careful with this source. Because the other guy did it is never a valid reason alone to create a feature. That's just copying. First of all, how do you know the competition is smart and isn't making a mistake with this feature? You'll also want to make sure this feature or product fits within your company's context. Furthermore, you want to think about where the puck's going to be rather than where it is right now. If you're always stealing, you'll never be ahead. But the benefit to this source is that you can see how the feature works in real life, how customers react to it, and what you'd like to do differently. Here's a simple example. For years, many PC manufacturers made stripped-down, slow, small-keyboard, low-cost netbooks, and many analysts kept calling for Apple to make one. Yet, Apple prefers high-quality, high-margin products, and instead of doing what everyone else was doing and what analysts thought Apple should do, it created the MacBook Air, which was incredibly small, yet had a full-sized keyboard, and eventually the iPad. Both leveraged Apple's strengths, both were loved by customers, and both had the margins Apple aims to keep. As of writing, netbooks are dead, and many PC manufacturers have created their own MacBook Air and iPad knockoffs. Business model and value proposition canvases. Another way to create an opportunity hypothesis is to explicitly analyze how a product fits into a business and how the product provides value for the customer. Alexander Osterwalder and Yves Pigneur created two tools to help you determine those elements, the business model canvas and the newer value proposition canvas, respectively. They also have two books with the same titles as the tools themselves that do a great job explaining these tools in more depth than we cover. Using these tools to look at your product, you might see a missing link that lets you think up an opportunity. Business model canvas. The business model canvas provides a way to look at all aspects of your company with a different framing than we showed in Chapter 2. It's very focused on people, values, and revenue, and filling it out requires you to list facts and hypotheses. We believe these people will be distribution partners. This tool was originally developed for a startup with one product, but it works for a product within a large company too. Here's what each block covers. Key partners. Who are the people outside the company, from suppliers to contractors, who make the business model work? What key resources do we get from them, and what key activities do they perform? Companies rarely do everything themselves, and working with partners lets you reduce risk and optimize your activities. There are generally three types of partnerships: alliances between non-competitors, strategic partnerships between competitors, and joint ventures to build something new. Key activities. What are the tasks a company must do well to deliver on its value? For example, Apple owns a number of key activities: software development, supply chain management, store management, distribution, and more. Samsung's phone unit is focused more on supply chain management and software development. Key resources. What are the most important physical, financial, intellectual, patents, copyrights, etc., or human resources the company needs to succeed? They can be owned or leased. For many companies making hardware, human and intellectual resources are key, whereas manufacturing is outsourced to an Asian partner. Value propositions. What's the benefit or value that a certain group of your products or services provides for a given persona? What customer pain points are you solving? The value proposition canvas will dig into this more, too. Customer relationships. What type of relationship, from personal to automated, do you want to establish with each persona? For example, a high-value customer might have a direct email for an account manager, whereas the average customer might only have online support forums available. Also consider what each segment expects, what you have now, how costly each relationship is, and how you expect to maintain each relationship. Channels. How does the company reach each persona to deliver the value, including marketing, communication, distribution, sales, and support? How are you reaching them now? What works best? How are the channels integrated? For example, are sales only via your website? Customer segments. Who are the key personas the company or product will serve? These are the most important personas that you believe you'll create the most value for, and they're who you want to prioritize opportunities for. The value proposition canvas will dive into this more. Cost structure. Where do your costs come from? This breaks down into fixed costs, salaries, rents, utilities, and variable costs, equipment purchases. For many companies, human resources are the greatest expense because people are needed to do key activities so that the businesses can deliver your value to their personas. Revenue streams. This represents the company's incoming cash. Revenue minus costs is the company's earnings. A company might have multiple revenue streams depending on its customer segments, and asking what value you deliver that each customer segment will pay for, what they currently pay, and how they'd prefer to pay, lower recurring fee versus higher one-time fee, helps you determine how to monetize each segment. For example, some companies offer discounted home editions of their products, which lack features that matter at work, such as document collaboration, that aren't useful in an average household. The home edition is one revenue stream, and the regular version is another. The business model canvas is great because it lets us write down all of our hypotheses from opportunity to distribution in one place. Using the business model canvas alone, it takes some deep thought to find a great opportunity hypothesis. Fortunately, the canvas's authors have developed a newer tool, the value proposition canvas, which drills down into the value propositions and customer segments blocks to really identify how the product is or isn't providing value to the customers and what the customer's needs are. The goal of the value proposition canvas is to help you achieve product market fit. This phrase simply means that a good number of customers want what you're selling. This concept is especially important to startups building their initial product, as startups need to find customers as soon as possible. If they fail to find customers, they either need to pivot the business to focus on new customers, possibly even a new product, or they need to close the business. This also applies to new features in existing products. After all, you want to build a feature a good number of customers will use. The first part of the value proposition canvas is diving into the customer. Completing this part of the canvas can help you refine your personas. There are three key aspects to the customer side: jobs, gains, and pains. Customer jobs are simply the things the customers are trying to get done, in their own words, be it a task they're trying to perform, a problem they're trying to solve, or a need they want to satisfy. For example, an Apple Watch owner is likely interested in easily tracking her fitness, a task, and looking stylish, a need. Customers might have multiple jobs, and not all jobs have the same weight. If you ever heard someone say fashion over function, that person's choosing a social job, looking trendy, over the actual task. Customer jobs align nicely with product use cases. Gains are the outcomes the customer wants to achieve, in his own words. They might be expected, and either required or desired, or surprising, ideally in a positive way. Gains aren't just from functional utility, they might provide social value. This makes me look cool. Elicit positive emotions. I love this product. Or save money. This is 1/10 the price. When talking with customers about the gains they want, make things as concrete as possible. If the customer says, it needs to be fast, find out what fast means. 1 second? 10 seconds? 10 minutes? Last, we have pains. These describe the obstacles preventing the customer from completing the jobs, along with possible bad outcomes and risks. Just like gains, try to make these concrete. If the customer says waiting for a taxi is a waste, ask how many minutes it takes until it feels like it's a waste. Also, try to gauge how bad each pain actually is. Waiting 10 minutes for a taxi is a pain, but does it stop you from trying to hail a cab or getting in it once it arrives? The second piece of the value proposition canvas is your products, and it also has three aspects: products and services, gain creators, and pain relievers. Products and services are fairly straightforward. What are the products and services available for each persona or customer segment? Gain creators refers to how your products and services create benefits and outcomes the customer wants, whether those are required, desired, or surprising. Again, these gains might be functional, problem-solving, or social, including cost savings. Pain relievers are how your product addresses the customer's top pains. You don't have to address every pain, but it should be clear in the canvas how your product addresses the key pains. Pain relievers and gain creators are the parts of your product that create value for the customer segment. The goal of the value proposition canvas is to make these two categories, to make this value creation, explicit. If it's unclear or a piece is missing, you likely have a great opportunity to improve your product. At the end of the day, product or market fit or feature market fit comes down to addressing the key customer gains and pains successfully. If the customer wants important gains that you don't provide or has a big pain point you don't address, those mismatches create a very good opportunity for you to improve your product. Also note that some products, especially B2B products, might have multiple personas, so you will need multiple value proposition canvases, one for each persona. As you work to validate your opportunity and learn more, redo your business model and value proposition canvases to incorporate the new information. You might even want to specifically call out what's validated and what's still a hypothesis. External factors. While all of the ways to create an opportunity hypothesis so far give us educated, good hypotheses, sometimes there are external factors, shall we say, that force an opportunity. The simplest and most understandable one is when a good business opportunity arises. For example, maybe a partner offers a large contract if a certain feature is added to the product within a given time frame. It's likely still up to the PM to make sure this feature's worth it, usually by measuring the cost of adding the feature versus the value of the contract. But this type of arrangement will often take priority over the previous plans. Next, sometimes in regulated industries, regulations change, and you have to prioritize complying with those regulations, or your product might be pulled from sale. The last qualitative method is also the most frustrating. It's when your boss or someone above you says, "Just do this." A good leader will have a reasoning behind the demand, or even be willing to change her mind if you provide proof it's an invalid opportunity. But not every leader is rational, and not all rational leads are able to explain their thinking all the time. Sometimes you just have to prioritize what your boss wants, even if it's not the best opportunity. Using the Kano model to find opportunities. In the 1980s, Professor Noriaki Kano created a framework to help teams uncover and classify three categories of customer needs or attributes. Looking at where your product falls can help you uncover opportunities to work on next based on unaddressed or unspoken needs. Furthermore, it helps you assess if investing in your opportunity will provide a worthwhile return, helping you transition into prioritizing your opportunities. The Kano model defines three principles that a product needs to achieve to be successful over time. 1. Value attracts customers. 2. Quality keeps customers and builds loyalty. 3. Innovation differentiates your product from others and keeps you competitive. Then it maps these principles into feature categories. Basic features. These are the things customers expect in a product, usually mapping to the value principle, and customers will be very unhappy if they are poorly executed or missing. Unfortunately, doing these really well won't make your users happy. It will just minimize their unhappiness. If you press the gas pedal in your car all the way and the car barely moves, you'll be unhappy. If your car is missing the brake pedal, you'll be very unhappy. If an app you have to log into is missing a password recovery feature, you'll be very unhappy when you need it. If you have the fastest, most nicely designed password recovery feature of any app, your customers will not be significantly happier than if you had a basic recovery feature. Basic features can be hard to identify when talking with customers, as customers expect them to be there and won't explicitly mention them. How often do you look for toilet paper included when booking an Airbnb? Generally, you find out about a lack of basic features from complaint systems, lost customer surveys, and attrition analysis. Performance features, satisfiers. These are the things customers are often judging your app by and the things they look for before purchasing. Your customers' satisfaction with these features will be proportional to how well you execute them. These are fairly easy to find information about by talking with customers, be it through interviews or surveys, because they're things a customer will often explicitly ask for, compliment, or complain about. For example, faster performance in an app leads to greater satisfaction. Having fewer steps to achieve a goal also increases satisfaction. Excitement features, delighters. These are the unexpected wow features that become product differentiators, innovations, and unique selling points, such as the iPhone's capacitive touchscreen, Android's notification panel, or Wi-Fi on an airplane mid-flight. When you do these well, they create significant excitement and delight. If they're missing, customers stay neutral. They don't know what they're missing. These features are the hardest to discover and really require an understanding of customer need. They're often found only qualitatively. Over time, each feature moves down in its category. Excitement features become performance features, and performance features become basic needs. The first time you had Wi-Fi on a flight, you were likely delighted to check your email while flying. Now, you likely expect planes to have Wi-Fi and are disappointed when there's a poor signal or no Wi-Fi. In general, the first version of your product needs to cover the basic features. Each successive generation should focus on a mix of satisfiers and delighters, along with making sure you're continuing to cover the basic features. To find feature opportunities using the Kano model, map your product and its features against the model. What features are about meeting basic expectations? Are they meeting expectations? Have you covered all the basics? If so, move on to a satisfier or a delighter. A big frustration for product managers is that basic features can require a significant investment to even get to a reasonable level. While you want to spend your time working on the satisfiers and delighters, skipping the basic features or doing them poorly will often lead to less customer satisfaction, even if you have a great delighter feature. If you're working on a new version of an existing product, consider what features started as excitement features but are now expected and something the competition has too. Or similarly, what's something the competition added that your customers now also expect? How does that affect your feature mapping or opportunity hypothesis? Touch ID started as a delighter feature on the iPhone, and now fingerprint unlocking is fairly common and expected on smartphones. What new delighters can you find to achieve significant customer satisfaction? Mover.io's hypothesis. Back in Chapter 2, we mentioned that when you book a move with Mover, the moving company does a follow-up call to plan details. Based on customer satisfaction surveys, it has been found that this is the thing that current customers who give the company a lower NPS complain the most about. Being a young business, Mover has to balance growing the business against customer satisfaction. The team did get together and brainstorm ideas, and the other possibility that emerged was some type of referral program to help with growth. But given how infrequently moves happen overall, the teams decided to focus on making customers happier first. The idea is that happy customers will naturally provide good word-of-mouth referrals. If Mover doesn't have good enough growth, they can try various growth techniques. After looking at the satisfaction survey results and the product workflow, this is what they came up with. Company goal: improve customer satisfaction. Product goal: reduce friction in the current workflow. Opportunity hypothesis: we can improve satisfaction for really busy Rob if we eliminate phone calls with the moving companies and consolidate communication into an in-app messaging tool. Success metrics: since customer satisfaction is our main goal, we can measure it by tracking our NPS. Other key metrics: other key factors that indicate if customers are achieving their goals and using this feature are the percentage of customers who complete the bid-to-completed move funnel and the number of messages sent per customer. At this point, as we did with Mover, we should have a hypothesis about the unmet customer needs you want to address for your personas, an idea about why you fall short right now, the key metrics you want to improve, and possibly an idea of what you want to do to try to address this problem. All of these elements should have some supporting evidence, even for blue sky opportunities.
Thank you for listening to the Product Podcast. If you like this episode, don't forget to leave a review on iTunes. For more product insights, head over to productschool.com.